Hi, I'm Yusuf Zine. My latest TVO Today podcast is on how a Canadian ends up in a Chinese prison and if he's even alive. Listen and subscribe to Extradition. Available now, wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome, everyone, to the first On Poly podcast for 2021. I'm Steve Paikin.
And I'm John Michael McGrath.
Doug Ford's government was sent reeling last week when it emerged that Finance Minister Rod Phillips was not working in his Ajax, Ontario riding, as his social media posts suggested, but rather was vacationing on the southeastern Caribbean island of St. Barts. The revelation cost Phillips his job and the premier a great deal of credibility with the public. We'll discuss it all on this Tuesday, January 5th, 2021, so let's get to it. John Michael, first and foremost, Happy New Year to you and yours. Hope you had an enjoyable break.
I did. I went to Curacao. No, sorry. I stayed home.
Too soon, pal.
I played video games and read books for my Christmas break. What did I miss?
What did you miss? Well, there was a bit of news out of the Ontario cabinet you may have missed. Let's see if we can get you up to scratch on that. We are going to dissect what has easily been the biggest political crisis to hit the current Ontario government in 18 months. But let me just say, and I'm not trying to be a smart aleck here, To be sure, December 31st, 2020 will be a New Year's Eve that Rod Phillips will not soon forget. He returned early from his vacation on St. Bart's. He spoke to Premier Doug Ford and either offered or was ordered to resign from cabinet. So let's start with this, John Michael. Was there any other choice but for Phillips to leave?
In the context we have, it sure looks like his choices were either resign or be fired. So I don't think that amounts to much of a choice in the end. But more broadly, I do think that there were a few details about this case that really made it difficult to defend, even if anybody was inclined to defend international travel in the current pandemic context. Probably the most salient one is the fact that based on the timeline we've been able to piece together since this all started emerging, Phillips must have been participating in cabinet deliberation over the latest lockdown while he was in St. Bart's. So, you know, this discussion over whether to lock down effectively the entire province at this point with new restrictions was only announced on the 20th or 21st, I believe. And from everything we've been able to piece together, Phillips was already in St. Bart's at that point. That, I think, understandably has caught the ire of the public.
Yeah, I asked the question because, you know, it has since emerged that other politicians in other jurisdictions also caught out of the country in sunnier climes, but none of them has been forced to resign. So maybe let's explore why you think this situation might be different.
Yeah, there's been a few cases revealed since, I guess Phillips was the first that, you know, set the snowball rolling, so to speak, using a nice winter Canadian metaphor. But some of the other examples don't really compare exactly. I think in the federal context of New Democrat MP Nikki Ashton, who she lost her critic role in the federal NDP because she traveled to Greece to look after an ailing grandparent. So, A, I think that's a bit more sympathetic a case than going to St. Bart's for a vacation and arguably would fit more in the definition of essential travel. And also, you know, Nikki Ashton is not a cabinet minister. She is not making government decisions. So that, I think, is a point in her favor, so to speak. The Alberta cases that we are seeing to come out, where at least some of Jason Kenney's senior advisors and some of his cabinet ministers seem to have been overseas, including, I believe, one was in Hawaii for a traditional family vacation.
Yep. It's,
that is that's difficult to defend in the current context. I have seen some reports to the extent that she may be resigning or is expected to resign at the time that we tape this. I don't know how that has played out yet. It's possible by the time this publishes, it will already have happened.
Right. Now, I guess we should look at the two reasons why so many people are upset about this. Number one, the obvious, that you can't very well go around saying everybody's under lockdown, we've got to beat COVID, so everybody stay home. and then you take off for a vacation. That is plenty problematic on its own. However, I think the additional reason why this situation has got Mr. Phillips in so much trouble is because while he was away, his staff were tweeting out pictures of him apparently working his riding, offering Christmas wishes in front of a fireplace, while at the same time those pictures were being tweeted out, he was actually down south. What significance do you think all of that played in this story?
I am usually reluctant to assign too much importance to tweets or tweeting or social media in general, which is, might be a funny thing for me to say, given people who know how much time I spend on Twitter. But it's really clear that those tweets did not help Phillips in this case. I mean, it would be one thing to travel, another thing to travel and sort of do it in secret. But it is quite something else to travel, not tell anybody, and then give the public the impression that you were adhering to all of the public health rules and, you know, staying safe at home. I can't imagine that that was the only reason that he was resigned, but it certainly didn't help.
Yeah, there was one in particular where I gather he was involved in a Zoom feed, and you can actually hear in the background what sounds like water lapping up against the shore, but the background of the actual Zoom feed is a, you know, quite clearly transposed picture of the Ontario legislature. Again, not, he obviously wasn't in front of the legislature because it was winter and, you know, he wasn't all bundled up and there was no breath being seen. But clearly, you use a picture of the Ontario legislature in your fake Zoom backdrop to give the impression that you are doing the province's business in the province. So these kinds of things have opened him up to the criticism that he and or his staff were being deceptive. Do you think they were?
Yeah, I think the long and short of it, I don't think I want to, you know, go through each and every tweet and try and rank how deceptive it was, but certainly the sum total at the end, after multiple instances of tweets saying, you know, hey, I'm here supporting this local business, or so great to be at home by the fire drinking eggnog, when you are perhaps in actuality by the bar sipping pina coladas, that's deception. And it is... I guess if I were an MPP in the chamber, I couldn't call it a lie. But it's certainly, by the standards of journalism, you would certainly call that deceptive.
All right, let's follow up with this. Tempting as it may be for the public to blame this whole thing on Rod Phillips, there is this added reality. Premier Ford knew his then finance minister was out of the country for a couple of weeks, but did not order him back to Ontario until the story became public. How problematic, in your view, is that?
This one is harder for me to suss out because we don't know what we don't know yet. And you could imagine this have gone, this could have gone any number of ways. The premier could have said, well, hey, fine, you know, you've traveled, but if you're found out, this is all on you, I'm not wearing this. If that was the kind of warning that a finance minister was given, maybe you should have been on the first plane back. But that's all a hypothetical. We don't know. Whether the premier will actually end up wearing this, I think, is one of these questions that really the answer relies more on how well do people take the response. I haven't yet seen any kind of polling on this, but my sense is that the relatively quick and emphatic response from the premier has perhaps put this issue to bed. Again, it's dangerous to sort of get ahead of ourselves here. We don't know exactly how the public is going to react. But certainly when I look at how this is still being discussed in Ontario, if it's being discussed at all, and it seems to have quieted down relative to Alberta, where based on the Alberta reporters I follow on social media, this still seems to be very much a live issue. My sense is that the premier might have avoided a lethal wound to his government, but we'll know better in some time after some polling has been done.
Well, like many journalists, I've been calling around trying to figure out whether it's possible that Rod Phillips could have left the country without the premier knowing, because that's one of the key things we've got to figure out here. On the theory being, almost as you suggested, it's better to ask for forgiveness than permission. Now, I don't know that that's what's happened here, but I do want to know if it's possible. And I've been sort of calling around. Is it possible that Phillips could have left and the premier might not have known? And every government insider I've talked to, literally everyone, from this government and from previous governments, every single person I've talked to has said, that is impossible. There's no way the senior most cabinet minister of any government can leave the country, particularly during a global pandemic, without the premier's office knowing. In which case, how damaging do you believe this is to Doug Ford's relationship with Ontarians?
You know, my sense is that people who were never going to vote for Doug Ford again anyway have added this as another item on the list. I don't see this as having sort of permanently damaged his re-election prospects with like the marginal voters that he needs. You know, everybody I think who pays reasonably close attention to politics knows the math in parliamentary systems. You don't need 51% of the vote to win. You need something like 40% of the vote to win. And so where a governing political party worries about is, you know, do they lose the votes that would take them from 40% to 35%? And so I don't see this immediately hurting him on that front, or at least no more so than everything else that is going on in the last 6 months. You know, but we're going to see. And, you know, we've mentioned Alberta. There have been cases federally there. I'm sure we will find yet more to come because this just keeps rolling out. But it does provide us a nice sort of political science experiment in the sense of watching different premiers and different heads of government respond in different ways. We're going to be able to see, I think, which methods work and which ones don't. And so, you know, maybe the Doug Ford response will work better, as I say, than the Jason Kenney one.
I think the question that everybody at the end of the day wants answered is this. Rod Phillips is a guy who has a lot of political experience. You know, he was a former chief of staff to a former conservative cabinet minister, Elizabeth Whitmer. He's a former chief of staff to former Toronto Mayor Mel Lastman. He'd been, I think, on the buses with John Tory's 2007 Ontario PC election campaign. You know, he'd done a lot of work in the corporate sector. I think he's a former chair of the board of Post Media, involved with Civic Action, you know, a volunteer position with that organization. And yet, despite all of that apparent political experience, in this case, he made what was so obviously a bad political decision. What are you hearing as to why that happened?
Well, I mean, perhaps the finance or the former finance minister will come on our show and tell us about it someday. But, you know, at the moment, we really just have a bunch of speculation and not a lot of hard evidence on this. You know, the thing that I keep thinking, and not for the first time, frankly, is, you know, one of the things about politics that makes it interesting and makes it unpredictable and, frankly, makes it worth covering is this is going to sound like I'm being deliberately mean, and I swear I'm not, but, you know, smart people do stupid things pretty regularly. And
I'll agree with you. That does sound a little mean. I mean, you know, anybody can do stupid things pretty regularly, but it is amazing how apparently smart people can occasionally make really dumb decisions.
Yeah, and, you know, we don't need to make this partisan. I mean, people are jumping all over Rod Phillips right now, and not without reason. But you could look at what happened to Bill Morneau last year. By no, you know, usual sense of the word, is he a dummy, a stupid person, smart guy, successful in finance? You know, a lot of his resume actually looks a lot like Rod Phillips in some ways, but repeatedly got into hot water over really poor choices about things like, you know, travel payments and disclosing properties that he owned and, you know, easy stuff that should have never come up. Morneau kept getting tripped up on. And now, like Phillips, he's a former finance minister. It's not a satisfying explanation. It's maybe not even the most substantial one, but it really is true in politics that being a smart person is no protection against doing something dumb.
No, that's fair. And the thing about Bill Morneau was he was a political neophyte. I mean, he was a...
Yes.
True. Both men were rookie politicians, But Morneau did not have a ton of experience in the back rooms as Rod Phillips did. And, you know, to me, that makes it just that much more inexplicable. Do you think Rod Phillips' political career is necessarily over because of this?
Well, clearly nobody is in a mood to forgive right now. There's a line that I first heard from CBS's John Dickerson that I like to remember in these moments. And he said something like, the worst thing about you isn't the truest thing about you. And in cases like this, I think it may not end up being the most memorable thing about you either. And for people in politics, you know, it is certainly possible to go on a rehabilitation tour. I think realistically, I would not expect Phillips to be back in cabinet before the next election. If the Tories are reelected after the next election, perhaps he will find his way back into cabinet. And so he needs to ask himself how he is going to spend the next, 18 months or so, I guess, less than 18 months even until the next election. There are lots of good, important things that a MPP can do, even if they are not in cabinet. He can find ways to make this worthwhile time, and then we can see what happens after the election. I mean, realistically, the only other job he would be looking for is eventually being a party leader, and that job doesn't open up until after the next election anyway, under any circumstances.
Well, I have, you know, at the risk of saying I've seen this movie before, I haven't quite seen this movie before, but the notion of a cabinet minister having to be taken out of cabinet, but then keeping their head down, doing their work well, being rehabilitated, to use your word, and they can end up back in cabinet again someday down the road. I've seen this happen numerous times. So, and apropos of what Dickerson said, the quote you used, and just so people know who are listening to this, this is in no way meant to defend Rod Phillips' actions, which are pretty indefensible. But politics is often a business where we judge people based on the worst thing that they have ever done. Yes. And there is a certain amount that comes with the territory in that. But if we were to put things in perspective, I guess we should put on the record that Rod Phillips has done a lot of very good and worthwhile things in his 55 years on Earth. And maybe in the fullness of time, he'll be judged for his full record and not just for his worst moment in politics, which clearly he's in the middle of right now. Anyways, all that aside, JMM, we should talk a bit about the new finance minister. His name is Peter Bethlen-Falvey. If that name rings a bell, it's because he actually represents the riding right next door to Rod Phillips. He's in Pickering, Uxbridge. He's clearly now the most powerful minister in cabinet. He is the finance minister and the president of the Treasury Board of Cabinet, which means he gets to set every ministry's budget, and then he gets to oversee all government spending. That's a lot of power with one guy. What can you tell us about him?
Like a lot of the current PC caucus, he was originally recruited into politics back when Patrick Brown was leader. And I heard from folks very early on in the PC party, before Patrick Brown's demotion from the leadership and before the election, I heard very early on that Peter Bethlen-Falvey was a guy to keep your eyes on. He was, you know, there were at least three different potential finance ministers after the Tories won the election in 2018, but Bethlen-Falvey was on every list I ever saw. Obviously, it first went to Vic Fedeli, and then it went to Rod Phillips, but now it's Bethlen-Falvey. He had a really substantial and successful career in finance before coming to politics, and this informs his politics. He might be one of the cabinet members who has been sort of most vocally concerned about Ontario's long-term deficit and debt situation. You know, when we first started talking about the financial response to COVID back in March, you know, Bethlen-Falvey's views on the debt and deficit were one of the things that we talked about. So he's, as you say, now without question, really one of the most powerful voices in cabinet aside from the premier himself.
I wouldn't say one of, I'd say the next to the premier himself. Which is a strange thing to say because we're in the middle of a global pandemic and you'd think the health minister would be the most powerful person in cabinet. But given the double responsibilities that Bethlen-Falvey has right now, I think it's got to be him. And political nerds may want to know that it's been 36 years since a single minister was both finance minister and Treasury Board president. That was Bob Nixon back in the mid-1980s. Now, some of you who are really on the ball might be thinking, wait a second, Hang on. Didn't Greg Sorbera and Dwight Duncan and Charles Souza also have both titles? And the answer is sort of. When they held both positions, Treasury Board was just a subcommittee of cabinet. It wasn't a full-fledged ministry as it is right now. So all of that having been said, can you describe the challenge that Bethlen Falvey has, given that he's only got a few months away from bringing in his first budget, which is an exercise that normally takes a full year, not a few months?
Well, I mean, at this point, lasting long enough to submit a second budget would be a triumph.
Oh, man. Listen to you. Hey, holy cow.
So far, Janet Ecker is still the last PC finance minister to bring in two budgets. So, you know,
Thursday, try the veal. I get it.
Let's not get ahead of ourselves, though. Bethlen Falvey is going to need to bring in a budget by March 31st of this year. And, you know, in some sense, I think that's going to be the easy part. You know, a lot of that cake is already baked. A lot of the big stuff, a lot of the big decisions have already been made. The current COVID numbers, frankly, are as bad as they've been in Ontario. And, you know, people can argue and are arguing about whether the government is doing enough right now. But I don't think there's any real prospect of them making major cuts to health spending or even education spending beyond the limited spending expansions that they've already made. So they are really going to be focused, I think, almost entirely on trying to get as much of the population vaccinated as quickly as they can. The goal is by the end of the year. But the Tories also don't want to raise taxes. And we do have this enormous deficit. And so one of their only real options is to hope that the money keeps flowing in from the federal government. It's been, you know, pretty generous with federal transfers in the last year. So Minister Bethlen Falvey's other job is going to be to, in relatively short order, establish a very good working relationship with his federal counterpart, Minister of Finance and Deputy Prime Minister Chrystia Freeland. If he sticks around long enough to present a second budget, that would end up being the spring 2022 budget, which will in effect be Doug Ford's re-election pitch to Ontario and an extremely important document for the Premier and his government. So, you know, no pressure.
Right. No pressure at all. Just the future of the Ford government in his hands, as it were. Okay.
Exactly.
We shall continue to watch. We always conclude this podcast with our favorite quotes of the week, which we'll present after we ask you for your comments.
Shoot us an email at onpolitics@tvo.org or tweet at us. I'm at JM_McGrath.
And I'm at S. Paikin. That's S-P-A-I-K-I-N.
Subscribe to the On Poly podcast on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, or your favorite podcast app.
Here now are quotes of the week, and JMM, why don't you get us started today?
I'm going to do something really self-indulgent for the new year. I'm going to quote ourselves from last March. Here is what you and I had to say after Rod Phillips introduced that fiscal update back in the spring, the mini budget, with what was then projected to be a $20 billion deficit.
The guys who came to office in order to put the books back into shape must just be shaking their heads at how they are going to go down in history for being the biggest, among the biggest spenders ever.
I think if you had given Peter Bethlen Falvey the option of either presiding over a $20 billion deficit or opening his own arteries, he might have picked the arteries. Now, you and I, Steve, say all sorts of things on this podcast, and I'm sure much of it is totally forgettable. But as it happened, after that episode was published, someone who worked at a high level in the Ford government told me Bethlen Falvey had actually used almost exactly that language about deficits well before the pandemic. And that source assumed actually someone had just leaked the story to me. I got to say, I actually just tossed off the line because I thought it was funny, but it might also be a bit illuminating about our new finance minister.
Well, to that end, let me suggest that I hope this clip will also be somewhat illuminating about our new finance minister. And this is from an episode of the On Poly podcast from May 13th, 2019. So I guess about a year and a half ago.
We were so young and innocent.
Yeah, it was an interview with Peter Bethlen Falvey, who was then less than a year into being a rookie MPP. And for a pretty buttoned-down numbers guy, he showed a really rare side of him here. He gets very emotional talking about his political hero, former federal finance minister Michael Wilson.
So when I moved to Toronto with TD back in 85, so I'm dating myself, I met Michael Wilson. He was in Etobicoke Center. That's where my parents eventually moved to. And he's been my political mentor ever since.
Brian Mulroney's finance minister
and a tremendous giver back to society. And he was the first person I sat down with and said, what do you think? And he was a role model who went from private sector to public sector. And he was very supportive and adamant that I should do this.
He just died. How hard did that hit you?
Very hard. Very hard, because he gave so much to society.
There's Peter Bethlen Falvey, who now, like his political hero, Michael Wilson, can call himself a minister of finance. JMM, glad to be with you for another year of On Poly Podcasts. And as my dad likes to say, stay positive, test negative.
Another one in the can. Stay safe, Steve.